and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught offside from a basement in Westchester and an apartment in Brooklyn. Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Andrew, I got in a fight with a flautist today.
I don't even understand how we're in a climate where that can physically happen.
So what happened was, at 7 o'clock in New York, everybody bangs their pots and pans, they shout, they holler out the window to you know, basically acknowledge the amazing work of our frontline healthcare workers who have, I mean, just literally kept the city from total oblivion. And my girlfriend Darcy has a vuvuzela. So I blow that out the window and it is loud. Like it echoes through the Brooklyn valleys, if you will. And today somebody, and I've taken this as a personal insult, from down the street, took out his jazz flute and played right towards the end of my vuvuzela playing and pot banging, and then continued for the next 2 minutes. When everyone else had stopped, you know, we'd done our acknowledgement and everyone had stopped, he kept going.
Who was it, Ron Burgundy?
Right. So I decided I wasn't having that. I'd already rolled down the window and put the vuvuzela away, but taking it as a personal affront, I went out and tried to drown out the noise of his jazz flute.
I don't understand. What was it about him playing beyond what you have deemed to be the allotted time? What bothered you about this?
I'm the horn guy on my street, Andrew. I'm the horn man of Park Slope, and I won't be usurped by this guy.
You know, the sad thing is, you're saying this tongue-in-cheek, but I believe deep down inside you believe this. Like, you believe that this thing that happens every night at 7 o'clock, yeah, it's about the healthcare workers and everybody, but it's also kind of about you.
It's mostly about them, but quite a large part is about me. Yes, that's correct.
Oh, that is beautiful. That's what the spirit of all this is about. What a show we have coming up for you.
Oh, this is such a show. I'm so excited.
I'm very excited about this, too. You know what this week was supposed to have been? Like, you know what we were supposed to have been sitting down here right now talking about?
Second legs of the Champions League semifinals.
Yeah. Yeah. Sad. Sad, right? And so it got me thinking, this time last year, the second leg of the Champions League semifinals, I honestly think it's the most fun that I've ever had doing a show, was the day that you and I hosted after Liverpool had come back from to beat Barcelona and Tottenham had come back to beat Ajax. Remember when you walked in, the hug we gave each other?
Oh.
We were both – it was the one day where we allowed ourselves to just, like, have total love for each other, for each other's teams, for the situation. And then afterwards it was like, oh, yeah, now we're going to play each other. But for that day, that second leg day, it was just so much fun. And the man who was on the call – of the Tottenham Ajax Champions League semifinal. Also, before that, he was on Tottenham Manchester City, was Guy Mowbray, who was, I said to you at the time, he was spectacular. Like, I kind of sometimes classify announcers in the context of big moments into three groups. There are those who detract, who actually take away from the moment. There are those who just blend in to it, which is fine. And there are those who I actually believe, as an announcer, help add to it. Like, you know, however big the Miracle on Ice was, like the U.S. beating the USSR in the 1980 Olympics, that on its own was huge. And Al Michaels' call even added another layer to the bigness of the moment. I actually believe Guy Mowbray was that good in both the Tottenham Man City second leg and in the Tottenham Ajax. When I go back and rewatch those highlights, as I often do, I get goosebumps all over again from his call. So I'm so excited to talk to him today. We're going to have him on for a long discussion, not just about that. He's been on the call. He's a legend. He's been on the calls of England World Cups, most recently against Colombia, that epic game. BBC Match of the Day. He's, you know, Premier League. He can talk everything. He's fantastic. So I'm really, truly excited to have him on for what should be a really fun conversation.
Yeah, and we cover so much ground, or we will cover so much ground with him. It's unbelievable. And you know, his World Cup nous, he was the guy who was the voice of England's run to the World Cup semi-final, the first time since 1990. So that's huge too. Andrew, before we get into the football properly, I wanted to do something. because I don't know, have you noticed that media companies and, you know, large corporate institutions are playing ads kind of reminding people during this crisis that they're still there?
It's utterly relentless, and I can't take it anymore.
Well, you're going to have to, because I commissioned a special ad, especially for us, because I don't want anyone to forget that we're still here, whether you like it or not. So I've had it voiced. Would you like to hear it?
Of course.
Okay, here we go, Andrew. It's very special. Here we go. In tough times, some things remain a constant, a comfort. They give hope. Others do not. Caught offside, we just won't go away.
It's going to be hard to get through the rest of the show after that. That was moving.
Did you enjoy that?
What networks can you see that commercial on?
You can see it late night after the Flex Seal commercials. We run it very late at night after the guy who can put the two boats together and then put it back.
Yeah. I'm consistently amazed by that. Every time I see that commercial, I get nervous all over again when he's in the boat with the sharks underneath him. Are you sure that the material is that strong that you're going to swim with sharks here?
Well, my concern for him is that if he does end up in the pool, I don't think he has the physical fitness to get away from the sharks.
I'm sure he can swim.
I don't know. He does not look buoyant.
All right. Let's talk about everything that's gone on over the past week. Like I said, Guy Mowbray coming up shortly. There's actually a lot to talk about here. I'm trying to think of where to begin. I guess we'll begin with what is concrete, and that is the French Prime Minister coming out this week and basically deciding for Ligue 1 and Ligue 2 that the season is over and there will not be competitive sports until at least September. So it sounds like the leagues are going to shut it down. We said last week after the Netherlands made their decision about shutting it down that we couldn't help but wonder if a snowball was beginning to roll and if you were going to start to see other leagues kind of jump on board, and they were just all waiting for that first domino to fall. The Belgian League has also said they will not come back. And now of those leagues, probably most prominently is the French League. I'm curious what you think of that decision at this stage.
I think it was utterly to be expected in France. This is a country where 2 weeks ago, the president, Emmanuel Macron, admitted mistakes and failures in their response, their initial response to the coronavirus. And the French right now are carefully and cautiously attempting to open up certain parts of their economy. And it makes sense that sports is going to be the loser in that. It's the idea of even forgetting fans in stadia. Just think of the idea of bringing together 22 plus, we'll say 60 players, plus ancillary staff, to crash into each other, to, you know, be close to each other, to take away medical staff. I knew the French were going to go in this direction. And I actually think, Andrew, that we know the Bundesliga, not to jump ahead or anything, but the Bundesliga, they've sent their plans to the government for approval. However, this week, there's been an uptick in coronavirus infections since they gradually relaxed some of their restrictions, I think, over the last 10 days. And it's likely that German authorities will not allow football, at least for May. So people were talking about the middle of May, and then they said, no, it'll be the end of May, but the Bundesliga will be back. Well, just from a statistical point of view, 0.7 in terms of spread is what you have to, is what the Germans were at. And you have to keep it under one. And the Germans went up to 0.96 since they relaxed things. So, I mean, if they're spooked by that, football's going to get, the can is going to kick further down the road in terms of sport and rugby and football. So I just kind of expected this, Andrew.
Yeah, a May 8th return or May 9th return that they were hoping for in the Bundesliga, which is in a week and a half. I mean, it just always felt a little too optimistic. And now we're seeing that hopes of that are fading. which is not shocking. Now, this leads us to the conversation about what they're going to do in England. I think there's a hurdle here that we may have overlooked a little bit when we've been talking about the league's return. We've been talking about a lot of the different logistics. What are they going to do about fans? How are there enough tests to go around to make sure players are being tested properly before these games? I sometimes wonder, maybe we didn't give enough credence to simply like, what do the players actually want to do? Like, these guys aren't robots. It's not a situation where England and the Premier League say you can go play again and they just get in line and do it. These guys have their own thoughts and ideas of what is right and what is wrong. And we're starting to hear now reports that there are players and there are managers from various clubs in England that are not comfortable with this, with a possible return in the near future. One source at a Premier League club told ESPN the following, quote, "A lot of players are very uncomfortable with coming back. The only way the league takes this seriously is when someone at a club dies. We will look back on this time with sadness in the future." That's a pretty strong comment there from whoever that source was. Now, there's going to be a video conference of all club executives this Friday, and they're going to further discuss the situation and when they think it's realistic to be able to return, and if they think it's going to be realistic to return. There's a lot of questions here. Like, there are clubs that are worried about, okay, let's say things are good up north and like Newcastle and that part of the country is okay, but let's say things in London are still bad. What sort of integrity of competition questions will there be if the London clubs can't play home matches, but some clubs can play only home matches? You know, so there's questions like that that remain. There's, I don't know. I've been saying throughout that the only option to me is to just end this thing without a fair conclusion. And I'm starting to wonder if I've been harsh in that assessment.
First of all, England is just, let's just look at things right now in the United Kingdom and in England. Andrew, they're way behind on what they need to be in terms of testing. Like, there will not be enough tests available to test the players on the regular basis that we would need to do to ensure there is no infection in this enclosed league. I read today in L'Équipe something that, I mean, if this is the thinking in football, or the thinking that's beginning to creep into the game, that maybe we don't see what we thought at the start would be some kind of conclusion. The president of the FIFA Medical Commission, the Belgian Michel Dehaut, said he was very skeptical about a return to competition in an interview with the BBC. He said the following, "The situation is different country by country. The peak is not reached everywhere at the same time, but today, April 28th, we are not ready for a resumption of football competitions," said the doctor, former member of the FIFA Executive Committee and former president of the Belgian Football Federation. And I'm just pushing that forward. Andrew, we're talking about a resumption of the league in June or July. I don't think conditions will be okay to do that.
And UEFA is setting a May 25th deadline for when leagues need to decide what they're going to do. And that, like, that's a month from, it's less than a month from now. And I don't know how much different things are going to be today, especially if you're seeing things like in Germany, where they're getting ready to come back and now there's an uptick once again in coronavirus activity. Right. Like, if that happens now in other leagues, like May 25th, leagues are not going to be able to definitively say, yes, we're going to be able to come back.
But also, if they do, that what they'll do is they'll submit whatever plan that they can put together, and the virus will dictate, because that's basically what's going to happen.
Well, here's what worries me. Is I saw this from Dan Rowan at the BBC, and he wrote this. He wrote, "With Prime Minister Boris Johnson preparing to return to work after recuperating from his own brush with coronavirus, the league was told Downing Street wanted top-flight football back as soon as possible to help boost people's morale after months in lockdown and to support the game commercially with many jobs on the line and the wider football industry desperate for a restart. Premier League bosses had let it be known just how important it was that the season be completed, pointing to the £750 million that contractually would have to be paid back to live TV rights holders Sky and BT. Whether the two broadcasters actually intend to demand all of the refund they're entitled to if the season cannot resume remains unclear. If the league comes back, JJ, I need to know that it's coming back for the right reasons. It can't simply be coming back so Sky Sports and the finances and BT Sport and the finances of that deal are worked out. That can't be the reason. And even, well, I'm not going to say even more than that, equal to that, look, I love sports. They mean a whole hell of a lot to me, as they do you, as they do pretty much everybody listening to this podcast right now. But I'm sorry, the reason for this game to come back cannot simply be to boost morale. This is too important. Too many lives are at stake. There's like, this is a matter of people's health. This is in many cases, it's going to be a life and death decision. It can't just be, we need to boost morale around the country, so we're going to put X number of lives on the line here. That's not good enough. People will just have to cope with a year without sports. I'm sorry.
Well, I agree with you wholeheartedly with that, but it is not a coincidence to me that the Premier League are on the hook for $750 million if this is not completed, and they're desperate to get it completed. It's not a coincidence to me that DAZN have not paid down the fourth installment of their payment to the Bundesliga, and the Bundesliga are mad to get this played. Like, those are just facts.
Now, I will say this. I don't know how this is going to go, but Sky and BT, for whatever greed, and maybe I'll be proven wrong here, and I'll be sad if I am, but for whatever greed you think is involved, not you, general you, is involved in companies like Sky Sports or BT Sport, I just simply cannot believe that they will demand a full refund. Like, there has to be, like, they've still received the benefits of having the Premier League on their networks week in, week out. They've gotten huge ratings numbers. They've been able to charge those advertisers and marketing. So, like, I have to believe that some sort of compromise will come, prorated compromise will happen.
Andrew, not to disparage our own, but these are companies with, you know, investors and shareholders. When's the last time a major corporate entity let anyone off the hook for billions or even created...
But don't you think that would be complete... Like, I would think that the Premier League could almost take Sky Sport to court if Sky Sports demanded a full refund when we've had 75% of the season completed. That's not right.
I mean, I think they would. I mean, I'm sure they'd have some grounds to do that, but I'm not a legal expert. I can't argue.
No, I know, me neither.
And I just want to say that, you know, the Conservative government pushing to in England, the Tory party and Boris Johnson pushing to have Premier League football back in the middle of the summer, when A, they don't have testing up to where it needs to be, and B, also, it's the second time during this pandemic that we've seen politics use, like, it will be a great diversion to have Premier League football back. Can you imagine the numbers? Can you imagine the engagement? It'll be a huge diversion from the people. I'm saying diversion, not morale boost. They've already used footballers and their pay cuts as a kind of a, you know, a smoke and mirrors job to deflect from the job that they've been doing themselves.
Yeah, I just hope that the Premier League here does the right thing, because they don't, early on so far, you know, they haven't had a great track record. Remember, when this all started, they were going to play until Mikel Arteta tested positive, and then there was kind of this, like, why? That was basically the EPL's Rudy Gobert moment. Like, they were going to go ahead, I think, and continue playing until he tested positive, and it hit closer to home for everybody.
There's blame to go around with that. It was absolute madness for the Cheltenham Horse Festival to be hosted, and it was crazy for Atletico Madrid to play Liverpool and for Valencia to travel to Italy. All those things were absolute, in hindsight, were insanity. Knowing even what we knew then. But
that's the thing, though. I just want to go off what you just said there. You say in hindsight. Like, I think that in certain instances, and people who have lost loved ones don't want to hear this, and I get that. But, you know, we can look back 2020 hindsight and now say that that was crazy. But I think you do have to put yourself back in the context of the moment when we didn't really have a great mental grasp yet on what this is. So in some respects, you can almost excuse, you know, the decision to have that Champions League match played and things like that. But to do it now, when we do know what we know, and we have seen firsthand just how dangerous this virus is, that's when there are no more excuses.
Well, can I take it back to the players as well? We have had scenarios where, in this country, where healthy and fit people in their 30s have died. Okay? This thing, the medical professions are only beginning to grapple with the complexity of what this can do to major organs, to the brain. We've seen strokes. We've seen heart attacks from this, from young people. I read an article in the New York Times about a 40-something-year-old fit person who had no underlying health conditions, and it took the most amazing acts and feats of working on the fly for them to save this person's life, right? We've seen, I mean, we really could be talking about a dead Premier League player when we consider the testimony of 37-year-old Pepe Reina. We really could, Andrew. And what we're talking about now is putting those guys back in danger. Also, putting elderly men in danger. Roy Hodgson, who is in the most at-risk category of age. Like, what's he going to do? He can't be with his team. That would be insane. I think we really need to... I saw John Nicholson from Football 365 tweet out about when would you feel it safe to come back to the games. And he had three different categories. And one of the categories was, I would only attend the game or, you know, go back to football when we have a vaccine. And I think the same should apply for actual competition. And that is tough, but people's lives are far more important than the execution and the ending of the Premier League or the Bundesliga or La Liga. I'm sorry. Yeah. Life is too precious.
You're right. Ultimately here, we just have to trust the people that don't have a vested interest. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like when Anthony Fauci says something in the United States, it holds weight with me because I don't believe he necessarily has a vested interest in whether sports come back or don't. I think he's just going to tell you the simple facts. So like, you know, those are the people that I trust right now. I don't know, government officials, TV networks, like, no, those are not necessarily the people who what they say carries a ton of weight with me. I'll tell you what, we've got a big, I'm looking forward to our mailbag. You sent me the questions earlier and some of these, you guys had great responses to the question we asked last week when JJ, rewatched the Liverpool Crystal Palace match when Palace came from 3-0 down to equalize and essentially end Liverpool's title hopes. A lot of you guys had good responses to the matches you would never watch again. We'll get to those in a little bit. It's a nice mailbag, very healthy mailbag. But now I'm so excited. We talked about this a few minutes ago. Longtime broadcaster. He's done World Cups, Champions Leagues. You can hear him on the BBC. One of our favorite guys in the business right now, Guy Mowbray, joins the show now. Guy, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm okay, thanks, guys, considering everything. Got my health physically, at least, and that's the main thing in these times.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of like the first and foremost question that's kind of most important to everyone right now. How are you doing? How's your family doing? And how are you getting by, essentially, during these last 6 weeks?
Yeah, we're okay. It's a little bit strange having a 13-year-old at home when she should be at school. And my wife's working from home as well. She normally works in a school, so she's doing a lot of her stuff from home. So yeah, we're doing okay. We're just there's good days and bad days. There's some days of boredom. There's some days of mild crazed euphoria. But yeah, we're doing as well as we can. I've actually just spent the last couple of days because I've got to the point where I feel I've got to do some work. I've been researching, doing some preparation for Euro 2020, which of course will now happen in Euro 2021. But I've done Russia, I've done Croatia, and I'll get on to Denmark tomorrow.
That's very productive, Guy. I've been following you on Twitter, and I don't want to call you out because you're certainly not lying. I well believe that you are working very hard. But I want to hone in on one of these tweets here. This is a two-part question for you. You tweeted on April 25th, I love playing my part in making those World Cup rewind programs, and I adore watching them. But they aren't half making me miss the here and now stuff. GNT time, I think. The first part of my question is, what part of the here and now stuff, the day-to-day of the commentary life, are you missing? And the second part is, what brand of gin are you drinking?
We'll deal with the second part first, shall we? I stay local, and I'm very much into York gin, which is from the fair city of York in northern England. And an old school friend of mine actually is a big player behind the company. So he's making the stuff. So I figure I'd better help him out by drinking it. Other than that, yeah, I would have said it was just the match days, the buzz around the match days, not just the matches themselves, but seeing all my colleagues and just everything about the Saturday, Sunday game. would have been the main thing I was missing. But I've realized in the last few days, it's actually the stuff from my home office. It's the prep. It's doing all the research and doing the revision for the games that I've been missing as well, which is why really I thought, you know what? I don't have any specific games to prepare for now, but if I get some of the skeleton stuff done for next summer's European Championships, okay, we're 14 months away, but it's all knowledge in the bank. It's not going to go anywhere, and I can just update when we get nearer the time. So that's what I've been doing. And actually, it's got me back into sort of some sort of rhythm, some sort of routine, which we all need to some extent.
Yeah, Guy, can I ask you about the routine of, we'll say, a normal week, a match of the day? Is there a ground? Is there a team when you see it on your schedule, you think, yes, I am going to enjoy this. I'm really up for it. What is your routine in the lead up to a Premier League weekend?
The routine is a bit like, I always compare it to when you're a student and you're doing exams. So for every game is an exam, and I've got to put the preparation in and the revision to know everything that could happen in that game. So there's a heck of a lot to do. It never actually ends. It's a 7-day a week job, if you can call it a job, because it is basically a paid passion, isn't it? So yeah, that's what I do day to day. That never ends. As soon as I get my rota sort of 6 weeks in advance, I'm prepping 3 or 4 games at a time. And as regards grounds that I like going to, all of them throughout the course of a season, because you never know where the good games are going to be. Obviously, the juices get flowing a little bit more if you're sent to one of the real crackers. I mean, the weekend before lockdown, I did the Manchester Derby at Old Trafford. The day before, I was at Anfield for Liverpool against Bournemouth. And when you go to those grounds and for those occasions, yeah, you do get a little bit more excited. But the good games can be anywhere. So I really don't mind going anywhere, because too often the actual blockbuster games let you down a bit. And some of the ones in the lower half of the Premier League table can be where the real excitement's at. So don't mind. As long as we get a good spread and I get to go everywhere throughout the season, that's the main thing.
Well, Guy, I'm going to do some gushing here. You did a couple blockbuster games last season. You were on the call of the second leg of both Tottenham Man City and Tottenham Ajax in the Champions League. And you're talking to a Spurs supporter right now, and I just want to say, as a Tottenham fan, it was an incredible moment, and you actually found a way to add to the moment. Your calls were incredible. You had a line in particular at the end of the second leg against Man City, when the bar review was going on, and you said, my goodness, as if there couldn't be any more drama. It felt like you had kind of been sucked into the match almost the same way that supporters of both clubs are. And I don't even really have a question so much as to just sort of, if you can kind of take us back to the moment of that game, the Ajax game, and just sort of tell us what you're feeling sitting there in that arena, watching that all transpire in front of you.
Well, first of all, Andrew, thank you very much for saying that. That's much appreciated. I got a little bit of goosebumps actually when you were just saying those words then, because I was remembering the end of that Manchester City game and just the confusion, the excitement mixed with confusion. You think Raheem Sterling's completed his hat-trick. You think City have got the goal to make it incredibly, you know, them to go through 5-3 on aggregate. And after everything we'd seen, you couldn't quite quantify that in your brain. And then you glance down and you think, hang on, this goal isn't going to stand. And I struck lucky in a way in that we just glanced and saw that the referee was talking to his assistant, and you saw him put his finger to his ear, and you just think, hang on a minute, he might have been offside here. And then the replay comes on, and by airing that, you have something to work on, because this was at a time when VAR was new to all of us. It still is, relatively. So there's a lot of confusion going on. We're getting used to it just as much as anybody else, as all the supporters and spectators around the world are. So there's a lot of very fast processing going on in your brain. And I think my brain computer went up from 8 gig to 16 gig in one swoop there with that one. That was tough, but it certainly got you going. And as for that 3-2 win for Spurs at Ajax, I don't think I've ever seen 2 days of football like that back to back in my life. The day before, Liverpool had beaten Barcelona 4-0 from 3-0 down first leg, and then Spurs from 3-0 down on aggregate. Let's not forget, Ajax were 2-0 up in that second leg. For Spurs to come back with Lucas Moura's hat-trick like that, 6 minutes of injury time, was it, the winner, the final goal, something like that. You get those.
I think it was right on. Season. Yeah, it was like...
Yeah. You get those games once every 5 seasons. You don't get 2 nights. That was, yeah, unbelievable. It was a great season. And actually, the final of the Champions League last season, we think it let us down a bit, but that would have been too much to ask. After quarterfinals and semifinals like that, we couldn't have had a final as well. That would have been crazy.
Yeah, I've always felt, Guy, that the line, I brought it up in particular, the my goodness, as if there couldn't be any more drama. First of all, I think it could get, you could get it printed on T-shirts, and I think Tottenham fans would buy it. But I've told the story before to JJ, just how, you know, how despondent I was watching that. And then, like, I'm not even facing the TV anymore. I kind of have my head in my shoulder, just like contemplating what had just happened. And then hearing you say that line, I sort of just like glanced back at the TV, like, wait a minute, is this not over? Like, am I being like sucked back from the jaws of defeat here? And it's just one of those lines that just, I think it resonates with me and with all Spurs fans, because it kind of just gave them new life to this run that they went on. It was incredible, really, truly great
you've
job.
You've just reminded me, you had the advantage of it being earlier in the evening in the States, because I know not just stories that I've heard, but I've spoken to a couple of people who actually did this. Tottenham fans in the UK went to bed thinking they were out. It wasn't until the next morning that they hang on a minute, how did that happen? They turned the TV off. They thought they were gone.
Oh my God.
And there's a number of people that happened to that night. So that just sums up just how almost ridiculous, and we use the word incredible too much, don't we? But that was not credible. That does not happen. But it did in front of our eyes. And that's I actually wrote a piece for the BBC website yesterday, which I think will be on this weekend. And it was just asking about various things about commentary. And they were asking me about a favourite goal. Now, I'm not great with memories of goals, but once I've done one game, I'm on to the next. And I don't retain. I can remember score lines and things, but the actual goals, I can't quite, unless they're absolutely out of this world, I can't quite picture them sometimes. And what I wrote about instead was, I remember Son's goal this season against Burnley, where he ran from the edge of his six-yard box the full length of the field. And I remember that one because you don't see goals like that very often anymore. You used to see them a lot. Now it's more about team goals and passing and shots from 25 yards maybe, but you don't see the individual solo runs as much as you used to. So that stuck in my mind. And it was the sort of goal, and it was the same with Lucas Moura's third goal against Ajax in the semi-final last season. There are certain goals that, as a commentator, test you. And they test you in not swearing. And they're the goals. They're the goals that I remember. The question I ask more than anything is, how do you not swear when you're doing a commentary? People see me in the bars and in the pub, you know, the local pub here. And yeah, my profanity is as bad as anybody else's. But when you're on air, it doesn't happen. There's an auto switch. You just don't do it. YouTube is the same. You don't do it when you're broadcasting. I don't know why you don't do it, but you just don't do it. Something switches automatically. But when a goal like that goes in, and you are dumbstruck for a second, you are very close. Believe me, I have been close so many times to just coming out with something that would be career-ending. And the Lucas Moura winner at Ajax was one of those moments. Just pause for a second. Don't say anything ridiculous. Something crazy might come out. And then you gather your thoughts.
And Guy, you admitted on Twitter that you nearly delved into the term. And I will. Sometimes we swear on this podcast we're not supposed to, and Andrew bleeps it out. Andrew bleeps it out, but in deference to the BBC and Her Majesty the Queen, I will not use the first part of what you were going to say about the Colombians. I will just suggest that it was housery of some kind of, you nearly said that during the commentary.
I did, and I watched it back the other day, the England-Colombia game from the World Cup 2018, and I actually got angry. Nearly 2 years on, I got angry watching it, more angry now than at the time, and I think it's because I was sitting at home watching it dispassionately, watching it away from it all, just as a spectator rather than a respectable broadcaster. So, I got angry. I was swearing at the TV the other day when I watched that back 2 years on, because their behaviour throughout that entire game was absolutely despicable. And it was, four-letter word, housery of order. It was dreadful.
Before we get to that, Guy, and that night against Colombia, because I do want to talk about that. You said something very interesting earlier on there. You talked about the microprocessor, the way a commentator is challenged by a moment. And it's a question I get a lot over here from American soccer fans. There's a stop-start nature to the American game, apart from hockey, that gives you a chance to maybe come up with something. Peter Drury said he didn't come up, or he didn't pre-rehearse the line about Manolis, the Greek god, in the League final, or the Champions League semi-final or quarter-final that became famous. Can you definitively answer this? You don't come into a game with an inkling thinking, oh, well, if he scores, I've got some snazzy wordplay I can interject here.
Spot on. I can back Peter up 100%. Absolutely not. You just don't do it. One, we're not very good actors. We react to what we see, and what comes out, comes out. I got asked about this the other day, and it was a line from a game in the World Cup in 2014. Hulk scored for Brazil. What did I say? Incredible. Well, that's pretty cheesy and pathetic, really, to be honest. But it's a natural thing. It's wood, but it's Pavlov's dog, isn't it? You say Hulk. Well, incredible Hulk. There we go. And that came out. And you don't. That's a poor one. That's not in Peter Drury's class by a million miles. I've done better ones than that. But that's the first one that's come to mind. And it's pure instinctive reaction. You might have an idea as you're driving to the game or when you're on the train or the plane. You might have a rough idea of you're going through the game in your head, and you won't ever pre-plan lines or anything, but you might have an idea, a spark that comes into your brain, and you might sort of put that into the corner for later. But you will never, ever pre-prep a line. The only times you do is for the team news at the start before the action starts. Once the action starts, it's about what comes into your head as you're watching the game live. And it's the pure reaction of what you're thinking at the time. And anything other than that would be completely disingenuous and wouldn't be proper commentary. And I'm pretty much certain that any commentator worth their salt would mess it up if they tried to do that anyway. We're not good actors.
Guy, I'm curious. You mentioned how you were watching England-Colombia, and even now, 2 years later, you still get angry at points watching that game. When you're broadcasting England, will you call that game differently than you would, say, any random EPL match, simply because you have the knowledge of knowing that the vast majority of people watching back home are all supporting the team in white or in red? Is that, will you call it differently? Will you call it more like a fan because of that?
Depends who I'm broadcasting to. If it's on the BBC and you are pretty certain that your audience is, well, it's certainly a huge majority of people are wanting England to win, then I might do. Actually, England games are the only ones where I might do them slightly. Any other game is down the line. It's one team against another. And again, it's a bit like the not swearing. The autopilot kicks in and you do watch one team against another. That's it. And you call it as you see it. With England, it's just a little bit different. You almost go back to your training in local radio. A lot of us grew up in local radio where you are watching the same team week in, week out, and 90%+ of your listeners are supporters of that team. And one of my early gigs was I was doing Sunderland in the northeast of England. I did every Sunderland game for 5 years. And they were great times. And you know, you do that tailored to your audience. You're not biased. You don't call things ridiculously like saying, well, how is that not a penalty and that should be a red card and all that. But you might make it a little bit clearer whose side you're on. You still call the game and the happenings in the game absolutely down the middle. But there can be a little bit of disappointment if they're losing, and a little bit of extra excitement if they're winning. They're the only differences that I would do in England, but that would be only if I'm absolutely certain that that's what the audience is wanting. Because if you didn't do it, you'd just annoy people. You'd annoy the hell out of them. A little bit like you would if you were biased in a game that, you know, a regular game. One of the Champions League games that I was saying before. I know we do get a little bit of criticism, some of us English commentators, for being... There's sort of this idea that when there's an English team involved in the Champions League, we're a little bit skewed towards them rather than, say, Ajax or Juventus if they're playing against them. I don't hold with that. I think that's nonsense. I think that's just, I always say bias is in the ear of the beholder. Who you want to win affects how you listen to it. And I have this conversation with football watchers all the time. If you're, for example, a West Ham supporter and you're listening to me commentate on West Ham against Manchester United, you're pretty guaranteed to think that I'm a Manchester United supporter. Or you could insert any team's name into there. Because you will hear what you want to hear. And if I'm not subscribing to that 100% with what I'm saying, therefore I hate you. And that any bias is always your perception. I can guarantee you any commentator that's got anywhere near top TV levels anywhere in the world will not be biased in the course of doing their job, because they wouldn't have got anywhere near that level if they were. They'd have been found out way down the line.
Well, Guy, I reject the fact that it's my fault that I've wanted England to lose every game for the past 25 years.
It's entirely
not my fault.
And by the way, you've been pretty successful at making it happen.
Oh, I unbelievable. And let's talk about the moment that my joy was shattered. Penalty shootouts in World Cups. I remember being but a boy watching the shootout against West Germany in 1990. And I've watched, I'm fascinated by England and England in major tournaments. It's, there's so much drama, there's so much intrigue, and there's so much tragedy. Shakespeare couldn't have written it himself. But let's talk about that moment. Eric Dier is stepping up to take the conclusive penalty against Colombia. Now, this is a moment where Guy Mowbray, I'm assuming, must feel pressure, because this is a piece of history about to happen, and your voice will be the soundtrack to that.
To be honest, 2 hours plus into a game like that, you're not thinking about yourself at all. You're just completely wrapped up in it. And again, what comes out, comes out. There's a few things with that. One, you've just pressed my buttons there. Because you know what? In an international tournament, as if I take myself away from being a commentator on the games for a moment, I support Scotland, I support England, I support the Republic of Ireland, I support Northern Ireland, I support Wales. And most
it doesn't
English
work the other way.
Do. I know it doesn't, but anyway, we'll leave that aside. We'll leave that aside. You knew what you were doing there. The other bit is that moment was the best moment of the World Cup for me. And there were a few reasons for it. One, it was pretty dramatic. And when we saw Eric Dier walking up, my first thought, and I am going to swear a bit here, was it's Eric Dier. There was a lot of us sort of looking around, eyes raised, going, really? Really? And, you know, there was a bit of panic. For some reason, we all knew Jordan Henderson would miss. I don't know why. He's one of my favourite players. He's an outstanding captain of Liverpool. But for some reason, I knew. I just had a feeling. You get that, don't you? We all get that feeling on the penalties when you just know. And I reckon I have more than a 50% success rate with my predictions. I've never done it scientifically, but you just know they're not going to score. Something's going to happen here. So there was a little bit of trepidation. And by the way, that was nearly saved, that penalty. It wasn't the best penalty, to be honest. Was it Ospina? It was the Arsenal keeper, wasn't it? Who got down, and the ex-Arsenal keeper who very nearly kept. But the best moment for me was at the end, where we'd wrapped up. We'd done the closing lines. I'm with Danny Murphy on commentary. We've wrapped up with our closing thoughts. We've just come off air, and I felt a tap on my shoulder, and I turned around. And leaning over from the commentary position behind us, which was occupied for that game by the stadium in Spartak Moscow, the positions were such that BBC National Radio 5 Live were right behind us. So some of our radio colleagues were sitting behind us. And I felt a tap on my shoulder. And it was Chris Waddle, who'd been doing the summarising, the co-commentary for the radio. And Chris just wanted to give me a high five. I'm going to go again here. I'm just 2 years on. Chris wanted to give me a high five. Wow. And he was in tears. He was in tears. Wow. And the guy that missed the penalty that was key in 1990 was in floods of tears, because it was almost like a cleansing experience for him. It had gone. The pain had gone. And then I started. And I'm starting again. Goodness me. Wow. That was the magic moment for me, to share that with him.
Yeah, that special guy. And look, I can tease and joke and everything. It's banter between the home nations and the islands back home. But I definitely felt, I was watching a BBC montage version of the highlights of England's World Cup.
Oh, it's great that, and, isn't it? It's great that. Really well put together.
It's beautiful. It's got the National playing in the background, which is one of my favorite bands. And nobody does high sentiment or drama quite like the National. That summer must have been just absolutely gorgeous for you.
It was, yeah, it was. I enjoyed Russia hugely. We'd gone into it with a lot of people full of trepidation and, you know, oh, it's a dangerous place and, oh, it's not very nice and it'll be awful over there. I never had that. You know, the previous two World Cups had been in Brazil and South Africa, and we were told they were unsafe as well, and we'd had nothing but wonderful times. So I had no worries at all. I knew it would be fine, and it was. It was a wonderful country. Everybody was hospitable. We had some great experiences away from football, apart from me nearly being arrested for losing something out of my passport in week two. That was quite interesting, for 4 hours in a Russian police station in a cellar underground with some strange techno house music. All the time I'm being questioned, there's some strange techno house music playing, which was very, very surreal. But anyway, we managed
to get
through.
To break you down.
They were, but we managed to get through that. And the whole tournament was fantastic. So never mind England. The best game for me was Argentina-France. France beating Argentina 4-3 was an absolutely outstanding game. I adored that. It was so exciting. So they were all good. The England games are sort of on a different feel because of the pressure. You can feel the tension in the studio. You can feel you get more calls from producers in the build-up, basically telling you how to do your job, telling you how to suck eggs. My job's no different, no matter which teams it involves. But they're a bit on edge. They're a bit tense because they know there's millions watching at home. So it takes on a bit of a different feel. As it grew, and we thought this could, when the draw opened up, we thought this could be onto something for England here. And that penalty shootout win just took it to a new level. That's when people started to think, hang on a minute. Quarterfinal Sweden was a breeze through to the semis. For me, the strange feeling, when I remember it now, was after that win over Sweden, I kind of felt, again, a bit of a sixth sense. I thought, we're not going to win the semi. We're just not going. It's too good to be true. And it proved so. And even when England were 1-0 up in the semi, when Kieran Trippier scored a brilliant free kick, I didn't get too excited. Maybe I had my professional head on. I don't know. But I didn't get excited. And I did in calling the goal, but inside, I wasn't exactly bursting thinking, I'm going to do a World Cup final involving England. I kind of just knew. Maybe it's years of supporting a crap team in England, York City, and all the disappointment. Maybe you just, and years of watching England at major tournaments. Maybe you just brace yourself for disappointment and anything else is a bonus.
Yeah, and maybe you score too soon, Guy.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt, yeah. I think the pressure did get to the players a little bit. And actually, semi-finals was as good as that squad should have achieved. They did brilliantly. They were superbly managed by Gareth Southgate. I really hope he can carry on and do great things when all this is over and we see some football again. But I think that squad achieved as much as it possibly could have achieved.
I think so.
Yeah. Guy, I wanted to bring you back, I guess, to kind of the sad reality of today and the Premier League. And JJ and I were talking before you came on about, there was a report at ESPN, I'm sure you guys have seen it over in England as well, about some Premier League players feeling a little bit uncomfortable coming back to their clubs during a pandemic. And I'm just curious, that's the players' side of it. How would you feel? I mean, if you were called back to one of these stadiums to broadcast these games, would you feel uncomfortable with that?
No, not at all. I don't have any worries on that score whatsoever. I would trust everybody to put all precautions in place. And I think you get to a point of what can you do? You know, we can't stay indoors forever. Going to have to come outside at some point. And this thing just will not just suddenly disappear. It's still going to be around. So I would go back and do games tomorrow if I was called upon. I do understand the reticence, and I haven't really got a feeling either way on whether it's right or wrong to be talking about a return at some point in June, which is what's being talked about at the moment. I understand some people will be reticent about it. I understand some people just can't wait to get it on. I'm just going to be guided by whatever advice I'm asked to do, I will do. Because I've just heard so many people saying, oh, we shouldn't be doing it. It's foolhardy. It's far too soon. But then I hear other people saying, well, hang on a minute. You've got a plan and we've got to make a comeback at some point. So if we can do it, why not do it as soon as possible? Listen, I'm not an expert on any of this. So I will just go with the advice given and trust the authorities, be it the government, be it the Premier League. I would trust them to not send us back anywhere until it is deemed safe to do so. I don't think it's ever going to be 100% safe for a long time. In fact, nothing ever is there? I could have an accident on the way to the ground. So nothing's ever perfectly safe. I would just go with the advice that I'm given.
Guy, before we let you go, you mentioned that you're a supporter of a lower league side. What's the feeling from England? From what the reports we're getting here in the United States, there's a lot of clubs who are not going to come out of this and may not survive financially. What's your read on that?
That's, I think, going to be an inevitable sad conclusion of all this. There will be clubs going out of business. And part of that is simply because a lot of clubs live beyond their means permanently. I think the ones that do go will be the ones that possibly haven't been doing things, in quotes, right for quite a while. They will be natural casualties. Every sympathy for the supporters of those clubs. It's nothing to do with them. It's not their fault that clubs are in difficult financial situations. I've thought for a long time that we have, and this is a controversial view, and I don't want any club to go out of business because it's all about supporters. But I thought we have too many professional clubs in the country, and I include my own in that. York City, we're now, you know, historically, we are a league club. We're one of the 92 historically, but we've been down now in non-league for how many, 5 years again, something like that. And we've been down for the last 3 years. And yet we're still a full-time professional club getting 2,500 people watching every home game. That can't be sustainable long-term. And the problem with this is there's no TV money at that level, not really. So if you don't have people coming through the turnstiles to watch the games, you don't have any income. And my club might struggle for that. I think we're in a better position than most because we're slightly bigger than a lot of clubs at that level. We're actually top of the division at the moment. There's a big talking point around my area about, well, the league should be suspended now and we should go up because we're top. But the team behind, Kings Lynn, have got two games in hand and are only 2 points behind. So they would have something to say about that. There will be no fair way of settling this. It's going to be unfair to somebody, no matter how you settle it. My take on it is, well, listen, at the end of all this, never mind the division and promotion, let's just hope we've got a club to support, because the league structure might all change anyway. The structure of the leagues, if some got a business, would be different. It's really, really sad. But haven't we heard for a long, long time, people have been saying the soccer bubble will burst at some point?
Yes.
Now, yeah, we didn't know it would come like this, but maybe this is it bursting.
It's a bleak picture. That
it is. Do something upbeat. Say something upbeat again. Come on, get us back.
Yeah,
on track.
Well, okay. I will. You've been so kind with your time. I got two more quick ones for you that are a little bit kind of random ones. The first one, it was something JJ mentioned in your Twitter feed before, which is great. I saw you tweet this. I forgot how weird some of Suarez's behavior was / is. Knowing that you were coming on, I was like, oh, yes, I get to ask him what it was he was watching that prompted him to tweet that.
That was one of our programs at the BBC are putting on at the moment, looking back at old stuff. And I've been putting together these World Cup rewind programs where we look back at great games from past World Cups. Now, we can't forget what he did to Chiellini, biting him in Brazil. But we had a program last Saturday night, and it was Gary Lineker, Alan Shearer, and Ian Wright. And they're at the moment doing a Match of the Day top 10s, and they're talking about top 10 overseas players, top 10, you know, various things. And last week was top 10 crazy moments from the Premier League's history. And one of them was Suarez biting Ivanovic in a Liverpool-Chelsea game at Anfield. Now, I don't remember. I called that game. And I'd actually forgotten I'd called that game. But I watched it back, and you could hear my voice at the time when we saw the replay. And why I tweeted that and put weird. Now, we all know got a past form for doing this several times and various other slightly underhand tactics on the field. But I'd forgotten the nature of the bite. He, you know, it wasn't just a sort of, I don't suppose a bite can ever be casual, but it wasn't just, he properly grabbed hold of his arm, sank his head. It was like watching something from a vampire movie. It was actually vampire behavior. And it just made me think that, you know, that's not just wrong. It is weird. It is absolutely weird. Because
inhuman, yes.
Yeah, that's a better word. You can do my job.
Guy, I don't want to cut across you there, but if you ever get a chance to Google or look up Wright Thompson from ESPN, did a great piece on Suarez pre the Chiellini bite. Mm. And it gives some kind of pop psychology and a kind of look into why he is the way that he is. It's a good read.
Does it conclude that he is actually a vampire?
yeah, it does. It does. That's the conclusion that comes to Suarez is a vampire. And also, you've not been short on the old controversial opinions on Twitter. You think Cantona was correct?
I didn't quite say that. I said at times.
Well, that's the way
times,
I read it.
Yeah, that's the way. Yeah, yeah. At times, I look back and think, yeah, I don't blame him. Quite honestly,
I do too. I do too.
Because you know, I get a little bit annoyed at some of the stick that players get. I understand. It's great. It's all part of the passion. But I think there's a line. There's a line that people know not to cross. And I actually admire the restraint. And funnily enough, we go back again to that England-Colombia game at the World Cup. How the England players kept their cool when all that was going on. Before Harry Kane took the penalty in normal time in the game, one of their guys, Barrios, followed him And there was a 2-3 minute delay before he took the penalty because of all the complaining. But as they surrounded the referee, one of their guys, Barrios, just followed Harry Kane. He just walked an inch behind him as he had the ball under his arm. Now, if that'd been me, I'd have turned around and clocked him one. You know, I mean, the restraint that the England players showed was, I think, it was Gareth Southgate coming out in them, because he was like that as a player and he's like that as a man. He's a gentleman. And I think the England players deserve, I think that's the high spot, actually, the World Cup. Never mind getting to the semi-finals. The way they got to the semi-finals deserves a bit of praise too, because there was a heck of a lot of provocation and they didn't write
once. Yeah.
Wonderful English restraint on show.
Guy, last one for you. JJ and I, we almost have like an obsession with loud roars from crowds after big goals. And sometimes when we have commentators on, I know you said you don't necessarily have a great memory for specific goals, but you know, like we've talked about Lee Griffiths second for Scotland against England, Aguero against QPR. Do you have one that you remember from a game you were at, like a roar that you were just like blown away by the noise of it?
I do, actually. And it was going back quite a few years. It was Celtic against Juventus in the Champions League. Now, would that have been, what year was that? I'm going to just look it up while I'm talking to you, because I can't remember what year it was.
2007?
Oh, now then, here we go. 2001. October 2001. And, Halloween, 31st of October 2001. Celtic 4, Juventus 3. I was working for ITV at the time, and I called the game at Celtic Park. And Lubomir Moravcik, the veteran Slovakian, had the game of his life. And when the winning goal went in, the noise, it's the only time I've been in a ground where the noise, actually, I had to take my headphones off because they popped, they cracked. The noise went so, it was sort of a, it just suddenly started whistling. It went beyond crowd noise into this whistle and something broke in my headphones. It was that loud.
Guy, we've long held the view on this podcast that there is a discernible difference between the English or the Irish roar and this guttural roar in Scotland.
I think you might have a point. Yeah, I wonder if that's become over the years because of the way the Premier League is and the sort of mass tourism thing that it is. Yeah. You know, it's not a 100% partisan crowd these days.
They all don't have the same accent.
Correct. Yeah, there is something particularly good about a Scottish crowd. And I guess when you get Celtic and you mix the Scottish and the Irish into one pot, then you don't half get one. And yeah, that game at Celtic Park was absolutely outstanding. The roar will always live with me. And that's the thing about when we go back behind closed doors, isn't that going to be really, really strange?
Just like an eerie silence kind of accompanying these games.
It's going to affect commentary as well. It's going to affect the commentary as well, because we're not going to go nuts, because the crowd is what gives you the heart and the passion. And, you know, you do preseason games. We all call games that people like to watch, but you have a different sort of vibe. It's a little bit more relaxed. You have a cup of tea and a biscuit on the go while you're doing it. You know, it's going to be that sort of vibe, because we can't, even if it's a great goal, we can't give it the full guns in commentary, because it's going to sound weird. Players will be looking up to the gantry and going, what the hell's he doing? You know, we'll try our best, I'm sure, and we'll get used to it as the weeks go on, but it's not going to be anywhere near the same. So it's going to be an interesting experiment if it happens, and I've just got my fingers crossed and I'm touching wood and everything that as soon as possible it can.
Yeah, we hope so too. We hope to hear you back in action soon, calling these games that we miss so much. We hope you stay safe. Guy, we thank you so much for your time. This was awesome. Thanks, Guy.
No, the same to you guys. All the best.
Oh, Guy Mowbray, that was awesome. Oh, my goodness, was that fun.
That's one of my favorite interviews that we've done. Andrew, when I told him I missed Match of the Day and the natural rhythms of being back home watching games and watching Match of the Day on Saturday and Sunday nights on the BBC, I meant that with all my heart. Uh-huh. It's just different class. It really is.
I feel like that is to you what like Chris Berman NFL primetime was to me growing up. Just like Sunday night, you watch the games, or you watched your game, and then you watched that to find out what happened in every other game. Like that was just the go-to.
Oh, it had these, like I said, natural rhythms of football watching life. And it's, by the way, it's the longest running football show in the world. Longest running.
That's incredible. Awesome. By the way, don't you love that his go-to moment for loudest roar? Of course it had to come from Scottish lungs.
It's where else would it come from? Remember when we played the Lee Griffith free kick against England? Boy, what a game that was. A sneakily underrated international game. And I think after that podcast, I replayed that free kick 10 or 12 times because it was just so amazing. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up. Unbelievable. Whatever they drink up in Scotland, it's something.
Yeah, and it's funny too when I asked him about the Luis Suarez video. Suarez has a category of incidents where if somebody just puts a tweet out saying, you know, I forgot how crazy he is, like, it can be any number of things. I don't know if you saw this, but I think it was the ESPN FC account. They tweeted a video the other day of Suarez in the Copa America last year going in on net, takes a shot. It's blocked by the keeper, by his arm. And Suarez turns to the official and appeals for a handball.
Looks for
it
a penalty.
It was the keeper. he gets out there. And in that same game against Chile in the Copa America group stage, a fan ran on the field during that match. And Gonzalo Yara of Chile, the fan is like running around wreaking havoc, essentially. And so Yara decides, I'm going to put a stop to this. And he trips the fan. And Suarez runs to the ref to try to get Yara sent
off. That's right.
He is one of these guys. Like, we talked about Clint Dempsey a couple weeks ago, how like the switch, they all talk about the switch, how it goes off with Dempsey and he's a different guy out on the field. Suarez is that on steroids. He's out of his mind.
That's why you must read. And again, it's not. I'm not just plugging an ESPN article. Wright Thompson, Luis Suarez, Google it. Wright Thompson goes into his background, the poverty background he came up in, how he, his love for his wife, his this like deep, almost, it's beyond, I suppose all love in a way, Andrew, is primal. There's a primal drive. But this is like hunter-gatherer, must provide and protect for my family at all costs. And he takes that mentality onto the field. He is like never going back to what he came from, and he will fight for his family. That's the way Wright Thompson positions it. Now, that may not be true, but it's an amazing take on it. And it's the only way to explain such absolute random acts of craziness on the field.
I guess it's a kind spin on his on-field behavior. How many people must he bite?
I don't know. Honestly, I am the one who went on this podcast in 2014 in an live during an interview with Dan Thomas and went to defend him. And
right immediately after we were on the air when he bit Chiellini.
That's right. We were on the air when
he was on the podcast, and a producer came running into the room to say that Suarez just bit Chiellini.
And then, in real time. And then Dan bit me for trying to defend him.
Let's see. Let's bite into this mailbag here.
This is a good one. Oh, my God. It's just, you are such a pro. Oh, such a pro.
This is what you're taught in higher levels of institutions.
Oh, the segues, the links. CaughtOffsidePod@gmail.com is the email, Andrew. CaughtOffsideESPN on the Instagrams. Follow us. We got new followers. I always respond to DMs as well. It's interactive. And Twitter @COSoccerPod if you still go on Twitter. Speaking of Twitter, this is the responses to games we could not watch again. So I've picked a few. Alex Sanchez, Mexico versus the Netherlands, World Cup 2014 was brutal.
That would be horrifying for a Mexican fan to rewatch, to have to see the Robin penalty over and over.
Yeah, that's got to hurt. Now, Mexico featured twice in this list, and the second one is not hard to figure out. Caesar, he comes up with the U.S. men's national team versus Belgium, which I wanted to reject. But then I thought, if you focus in on the Wando miss, then it makes sense. Because really, that game should have been 6-1 Belgium.
I haven't gone back and rewatched the entire thing since. But I have rewatched the Julian Green goal multiple times.
Right.
Like, there were some moments, like, that was, you know, the DeAndre Yedlin breakout game. They're still, Belgium was so good. So you could, I don't know. I'm not sure I fully, there are worse U.S. losses for me than that. I would think that when the U.S. lost to Ghana in 2010, I think that would hurt more.
I mean, 2-1 taking Belgium to extra time is still admirable.
You know? I think the Wando miss, I think, adds a layer of hurt to it. So you just fast forward through the 87th minute or whenever it was when that happened, the 88th minute. What else you have?
Poor old Wando. Another entry for I'm never watching that again is from an Arsenal fan on Instagram. Never watching the 8-2 defeat to Man United.
No.
That was horrifying. Was that the one where Wenger was forced into the, he was sent off for kicking a bottler.
He didn't know where to go, right?
Yeah, and he went up onto this little plinth where he stood there surrounded by United fans taunting him. Yeah. It was almost like one of those 1950s renditions of a biblical passage where there's, you know, someone is taken into a crowd and they're just taunted. It was awful. That was probably his most embarrassing moment, I would think, as well. Tottenham makes me cry. Indeed, it does. There is a mark in the record book of a Newcastle 5-1 Spurs match that I believe never happened.
So this happened at the end, the final game of the 2015-2016 season. It's just amazing that it's one of the great Tottenham seasons in recent history, and yet the way it ended, it casts such a negative light over the entire season that it's almost hard to look back on that year fondly. Like, they were rolling, and then you had the awful 1-1 draw to West Brom. After that was the battle at the Bridge, which essentially ended their season, but you were still playing to finish ahead of Arsenal. Then they lose to Southampton, and then an already relegated Newcastle. Tottenham just have to beat them on the final day to finish ahead of Arsenal, and they get absolutely blown out of the place, 5-1. That was really, really bad. Really, really. That's a good call by him, yeah.
Eddie Sanchez, the 2018 Copa Libertadores second leg in Madrid. Losing that final to them is something I don't want to relive. Hashtag Boca Juniors forever.
I love that he says them. He won't even refer to them by name.
I would doubt Eddie Sanchez has ever said River Plate without then spitting. I would very much doubt that. Eduardo. Well, this is the one I referenced earlier. Chile 7, Mexico 0. Copa America Centenario.
Yeah.
Can I tell you something funny? Actually, not that funny, but I found it funny. I watched the first half at home and I couldn't believe, I think most of the goals were scored in the second half. I'm not sure. Maybe I was already in the Colombian restaurant. Anyway, I'm in a Colombian restaurant and the waiters have the game on and I can't believe what I'm seeing. I just can't, because I genuinely didn't think Chile were that much superior to Mexico, but there we were. And some of the waiters were like grabbing their sides, falling around laughing. So I presume they were the Colombian waiters. And there was other guys who were, I guess, were Mexican kids, were absolutely like crestfallen. And they were kind of shouting as if making the gesture to have it turned off, which, incredible.
It was horrifying, that game.
And the final one... One guy tweeted us that his game he couldn't watch again was an NYCFC 1-1 draw with Red Bulls in the derby. And the reason he was upset was because Red Bulls had lost, had two men sent off, and NYCFC still couldn't win. I was like, okay. I suggested that might not meet the criteria, because in a derby, surely you draw or you win. The most important thing is you don't lose.
Yeah.
That would be my criteria for a derby. Not only, Andrew, did he delete his suggestion, he then deleted his account.
Oh, my God. You ran him right off social media?
Holy crap. Yeah, unbelievable.
That's sad. That is really sad.
All right, let's move on from this frippery. Shad Larson.
This is unbelievable.
This is a bit out there, actually. JJ and Andrew, thanks so much for continuing the podcast through all of these rough times. It's been really nice to get soccer-related material every week. You're very welcome. I thought I'd share some good news with you that is somewhat soccer-related. Well, I would go as far as to say, Shad, it's very soccer-related, and you made it that way. My wife had a baby boy last week, and in exchange for me agreeing to buy her two cats. What, is this a fairy tale? I will sell you a child if you give me cats. I was able to name him after my favorite soccer club, Everton. Attached is a picture of baby Everton Hunter Larson with his Everton beanie on. Hope this lifts you guys up a little, even though you're a Liverpool fan, JJ. Thanks again for the pod and stay safe. Look,
Shad's wife is a saint.
What an amazing woman. Shad, I just want to say that is your kid, the picture of your kid. My God, so gorgeous. Absolutely beautiful. And I think it's really cool. I just can't believe your wife allowed it. Cannot believe it. And by the way, because your last name is Scandinavian somewhat, if you say his name quickly, he sounds like a mid-90s footballer who played centre-back for Norwich. Everton Hunter Larson.
I'm trying to think of how many clubs this could work for. Like Everton, look, Everton by no means is a common name, but it could work as a name. Like Liverpool is not a name. Tottenham is not really a name. Like I'm trying to think of how many clubs you could actually name your child after directly.
Well, I do think that
Bristol could.
I'm sure other people did it before him, but I do feel like location naming started with David Beckham calling one of his kids Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact that it's very common. You'll have when Gerrard was at his pomp for Liverpool, you had plenty of Stevies in the Merseyside region, but to call them after the name of the club is wow.
Yeah.
That's something.
Bold. It's very bold.
Very bold.
What else?
Brandon from New Jersey, a place very close to my heart. As this month marked my 5-year anniversary of finishing business school, I was looking through some old work and found my proposal to be a Fulbright scholar in the United Kingdom. My final proposal focused on the differences in fandom and support among professional sports in the United States and the United Kingdom. At the time, and still am today, I was fascinated that football clubs had supporters, but American professional teams had fans. Football clubs were steeped in traditions such as songs, rituals, and alike. I was curious as to why that never transferred over to major American professional sports, NBA, NHL, MLB, NFL. Rather, college sports are more similar in the support of culture to that of football clubs. Alma maters are sung, students have specific traditions and rituals, and the importance of traveling fans that are located in specific parts of the arena. As two people who have come to sports in different ways, Andrew with his UK football club, JJ adopting American sports culture, why do you think supporter culture is so different than fan culture? Why have American professional sports, with the exception of soccer, not caught on to major supporter traditions?
So I have a
great question.
It is a great question. I have a theory on this that I assume that he's talking about in-stadium atmosphere. Because outside of that, I actually do think that fan culture is not all that different in the way people follow their teams religiously. I think he's talking about in-stadium atmosphere. At least that's how I'm going to read into it. And I think much of that, I'm envious of what we see in terms of in-stadium atmosphere in England as opposed to what we see here. Not to say that games are dull here, but it's a different level of atmosphere at a Premier League or a lot of European soccer matches. And I think a lot of that is driven by the away section. Because I think when you are on, you know, somebody else's territory, surrounded by your people, you feel this intense pride. And so you're going to be loud and you're going to show that pride. And then that is then met with the home crowd. Well, we can't be outdone in our own building by the visiting team's fans. So then they have to then meet that with their own enthusiasm. And I think it just creates that feel throughout a match. And I understand why there aren't away sections in American sports. Like teams don't play close enough to each other where you could have that game in, game out. It's a cool element of sports in England. But it's a shame because I really think that would go a long way in creating a similar atmosphere.
I think part of it is to do with the amount of games. I think the NBA and MLB seasons have a stultifying effect on supporter culture. It is just not possible to go to every game. You can't go home and away, whereas there's a home and away culture in English football where the hardcore supporters travel and they go to the home games as well. I think distance makes a difference. I also think there are younger teams in American sports, whereas most teams almost all teams in the top flights, or certainly in the football league, all go back 100 years.
Yeah.
So there's this generational pass on, which you have in college. You have that in college sports. There are kids who've never gone to Penn State, whose parents had an affiliation to Penn State, and they go on and they support them. There's a depth there. There's also, I think, as well, Brandon, and I'd love to go into more depth on this. Maybe I'll get a chance at some time. I think there's a real understanding in the American football, or sorry, the American sports fan, that they are consumers, that they are customers. You'll hear American fans just talk about franchise and organization. It just trips off the tongue. It's a transactional relationship in some cases. And I think if you look in the case of the New York Yankees, if the New York Yankees next season did not win X amount of games or were not in the playoffs, their attendances would absolutely plummet. There would be no atmosphere in the stadiums. You wouldn't have that at Leeds United. Leeds United, when they were in the third division of English football, were bringing 7,000 people to Exeter at an away game. You know, there's a depth of connection there that the fans are the club and the club are the fans. And I really don't feel that is...
I think it varies.
It varies. I think there are exceptions. I think the Boston Celtics in basketball, I think the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Green Bay Packers are those exceptions. But again, look how long they've been going. I think the New York Giants to an extent, but not exactly. Mm. Not exactly. Yeah, is right. You want to see how many empty seats when they have a sucky season towards the end. I do think there's a fiscal and transactional nature to sports in the United States that fans subconsciously are very much aware of.
Yeah, that all factors in. Also, too, the format of an American sports season. Our seasons end in playoffs. So, like, let's be honest, the playoffs, you'll get that kind of atmosphere. But if you're talking about, like, a mid-July Braves, Pirates, like, there's just some games that are just hard. Like, you just know this game doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and Andrew, I think that affects in-stadium support. Also, one other thing, with the exception of the NHL, the NHL is pretty close to soccer support in some cities. It really is.
Yeah, Montreal, but, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. But I will say this about the NFL, and I will say this about the NBA as well to an extent, and particularly baseball. It's impossible to get an atmosphere going if it's a stop-start as that. Like, it's nigh on impossible. You see a bit of excitement. You're pumped when the offensive tackle makes this amazing play, and you're pumped and you're on your feet. And then there's this absolute just long break before anything else happens. And that really, in football, when the fullback smashes into the winger for a tackle, that's the first of a continuous line of things that will happen.
Yes. When you say football there at the end, you're talking American football or soccer?
When the fullback smashes into the winger.
Okay.
I'm talking soccer.
All right. Now, I don't mean to be like Joe America here, my American brain defending American sports, but let's not act like soccer doesn't have its fair share of lulls in the act.
Oh, my God. Absolutely. But there are things continuously happening.
All right.
And so you can sing through those things. You'd look really, you know, I mean, in the NFL, we are compelled to sing things. Or not the NFL, the MLB. We're compelled to sing things because there's a person on an organ there. They're well aware this is a deathly boring sport at times. You know?
Let's see. What else do you have?
Liz in Sao Paulo finishes up, Andrew. This is really great. I love this. And it kind of speaks to the soul of the nation, if you will. I thought you might find it interesting to hear a nugget about Brazilian soccer on TV during quarantine. Of course, sports channels have been replaying old games since all sports were suspended. But one of the major channels has been showing historic games every Sunday afternoon when Brazilian or state league games usually happen. So today they aired the original broadcast of the 94 World Cup final and had Romario and Bebeto calling in throughout the game to discuss it. Right before the penalties, they showed video messages from both the Brazilian and Italian keepers about their memories of the game. When Brazil won their tetra, which is third world championship, with Baggio's air ball, I heard cheering horns and fireworks out my window in Sao Paulo like I would normally hear when a big game is on. It's been a nice way to keep soccer alive and remember some great historic moments in the country's soccer history.
That's pretty cool.
That's awesome that people still celebrate something they know has happened like 25 odd years ago. I would say, Liz, they needed Bebeto and Romario to call in for that game. What a stinker. Oh, my God. If ever a World Cup final stank the place up, that was it. Yeah. It was so bad that during the game, Gianluca Pagliuca fell asleep and on an easy basket, breadbasket catch, it hit his arm, his upper arm, and hit off the post and came back to him, if people remember that game. It stank. Oh, awful.
That has gone on here too, though, with because there's been a ton of games being rebroadcast. Like I saw, they on CBS Sports Network they replayed the Syracuse Kansas National Championship game, and on they did a Facebook Live of a bunch of Syracuse figures from that game. Carmelo, as you refer to him, Coach Oldman, Jim Boeheim was there. The whole team checked in and commented on like all the behind the scenes of stuff from that game. So I've seen a lot of that, which is. Look, we all have this fix that we just like need to get from somewhere. So we're getting it right now through the Last Dance documentary and just rewatching old games. I got sucked in last night, JJ. Just go on YouTube and just type in great sports moments and like so many incredible, like professionally done montages of just like normal guys who just like are bored and want to make these videos. There's some great stuff. And I was watching, it was 26 minutes long. And I got to the end, I was like, damn, I really miss sports right now.
By the way,
I'll cut you off real quick. There was only, I think, one soccer moment in the whole montage. You know what it was? Mm-hmm. Watford Leicester. Almunia saves the penalty. Deeney scores at the other end.
The one thing me and you will never argue about.
Yeah.
One of the greatest passages of play we have ever seen.
I'm still in awe of it every single time I see it.
I might watch that back later.
Yeah.
By the way, just before we get out, The Last Dance. So I find Rodman, Pippen, Jerry Krause, Phil Jackson, all these people absolutely compelling and much more compelling than the main protagonist.
No.
But the main protagonist is so utterly compelling from his ability to play. But
you're wrong.
But what? No. And the reason Jordan might be compelling, the crossover between him and Roy Keane is unbelievable. They cannot understand people who are not as talented A or as B driven as them.
Okay.
They can't get into their heads.
But like, I thought you're not suggesting though that like the Jordan interviews aren't compelling. That
no.
Like when he's talking about the hate that he still feels today for Isaiah Thomas and the
no, fans. But yeah, that's compelling in the same way Roy Keane is compelling. He has the same hate. Roy Keane still, right now, has the burning fires that Jordan still has. But it's why they could never be coaches, and have failed as coaches in terms of Roy Keane
because they can't relate to the common player.
They cannot relate to the common player. But by the way, before people start chiming in. Jordan was a more skillful player than Roy Keane was a skillful soccer player. But Roy Keane and Jordan, to quote from The Last Dance, did their jobs better than anybody in sports, any employee has ever done their jobs. That's a fact.
Yeah.
And when I hear Michael Jordan talk, I'm like, Keane and Jordan are cut from the same stone. They couldn't possibly understand mediocrity. They couldn't understand players who didn't want it as much as them, like they couldn't understand failure.
Yeah, much like myself, which is why this podcast is just grueling week in, week out for me. Yeah, that's a reference to you. You make it hard, and like
nobody's buying that anymore. Don't you love this? Is the highlight of your week, and don't even lie about it.
It's a low bar, but yes, that is in fact true. These weeks are tough, man.
Can I say the final thing I'll say before we get out?
Yeah.
I was going to bed the other night and I was kind of feeling a bit sad because the next day was going to be a bit like the day that had just passed. And I thought about when we went into the studio to preview the World Cup final and we had James Montague on from Zagreb.
I remember that interview.
To talk about Croatia and the country. And we just did this brilliant World Cup preview. I'm so proud of that. And then me and you got out and we went for a burger and a beer. And all probably through that period, I'm thinking, how can we make the podcast better? How can we drive things on? And now I reflect on that time. How good was life? How amazing was that?
What a fun, that was a fun day. I remember that, yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, I these things, these thoughts have been sustaining me.
Yeah. Oh, there will be good days again. Trust me. There will be good days again. I just know it.
I'm sorry, Andrew, but you are not a man that can deliver a line like that and deliver hope.
All right, then you say it.
There will be good days. There will be good days again.
This was fun. This was a good day. I enjoyed this. I enjoyed Guy Mowbray. He was great to talk to. Our thanks to him. He gave us a lot of time there. That was really, really fun. Hey, we'll do this again next week. To you, I say...
Check you later, fun boy.
See ya.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.